This is the Northwoods American Indian Experience, examining the evolving experience of the Chippewa people in Minnesota. This series made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program continues examining the historic experience. Our resource people are Red Lake Tribal Historian Tom Kane, University of Minnesota American Indian Studies Chairman Dr. David Bolio, and Bemidji State University professors Dr. Dolores Norman History and anthropologist Alan Brew. Moderator Bruce Baird of South Dakota Public Television begins the discussion with this crucial question.
If we look at today's day and age, a lack of ability to exercise sovereignty in its fullest sense for Indian tribes, the Bureau of Indian Affairs enters, Department of Interior enters, and the federal government as a whole enters. And it even gets down to very narrower terms and area Bureau of Indian Affairs directors and even reservation superintendents. There are still some powers vested in these people to either prevent a tribe or to limit a tribe in its exercise power. How can sovereignty, in terms of what we've been discussing, the ability to exercise that power, be expressed today under the conditions that we have today? Are we necessarily looking at a major change in federal-Indian relationship?
I can't answer that question directly, but I think it's useful in these discussions, while recognizing obviously that there's special historical and special legal situations involving reservation peoples and off-reservation Indian peoples. I think it's useful to remember that what we're dealing here is a bureaucracy. A bureaucracy that is dispensing funds and is responsible for the dispensation of those funds. And the very nature of the bureaucracy is to restrict the freedom of action on the part of the recipients of those funds. We can see the same problems in many ways expressed by neighborhood action committees, by various efforts by cities or states to make use of federal funds as they please. There is a considerable bureaucracy, considerable restriction on use throughout the federal system. And while certainly the reservation situation is a special one, I think there are the basic philosophical situation is expressed generally in the use of federal funds by non-federal agencies. I think it's useful to at least keep that in the back of our minds when we're trying to talk about this.
That's the fear of the loss of the federal protections of some special rights that Indian people may have in their connection with the federal government.
There's two aspects in the past to the trustee relationship. First has been protection of Indian lands and resources, and then the management by the federal government of those lands and resources. It's defined as active trust, both protection and management. What Indian people, I think, have been trying to do over the years is to gain more and more of the management of their own affairs under the federal protection of their lands and resources. It's difficult to do that since a bureaucracy doesn't like to get itself out of business at all.
The bureaucracy doesn't want to split itself either.
I would tend to think that that's the goal. I don't think Indian people want to lose the protection. Because it's vital to protect Indian interests against state and other kinds of jurisdictions that intervene. It's not only the federal government which intervenes in tribal jurisdiction, but state government, local government. And it intervenes in the most subtle ways. At times, you don't even understand how it intervenes, because it's all around you at times. Where you get a parking ticket from, you know, is a matter of jurisdiction, sovereignty. Where you have to go to pay your state hunting and fishing license, where you can hunt and fish, when you can hunt and fish, where you send your children to school, what they learn, who teaches them. And when you start thinking in that way, the aspect of sovereignty isn't something that we can intellectualize about. It is the fundamental element that will keep or that will enable Indian people to control their own lives and their own, not control, I'm losing a sense of my words right now, but it's fundamental to the life of a community.
It seems to me that...
It's the fundamental right of parents, essentially, to educate their own
children. That's my question, is going to be...
And it's a natural right.
either through the children or the government. After all, you know what we are, ancestors of people yet unborn. That's right. What we are. So that's a lot of responsibility as to how you set up this program if it's ever going to get into operation.
There was a man, a Canadian Indian, who was the head of the Indian Brotherhood, George Manuel. And he says our future is more dependent on our grandchildren than our grandfathers. Mm-hmm. And it is what we say to them that matters, the future. It's how we talk to them. It's what we say. It's how we are with them. And I guess it's that fundamental right that we want that right recognized as mm-hmm. Indian people. And that means that all the other aspects, the federal government and the state and so forth, have always intervened in that basic right.
When I was going to high school, Indian people were saying that the two worst things that the white man ever gave an Indian was liquor and an education. Well, that was Indian people saying that. Since that time, however, the education of Indian people has become a prime directive amongst Indian people. And in that education process, Indian people, as they become more knowledgeable of what's happening around them and of what happened to their people, have begun asking more questions. And I have a theory. The treaties were originally written with the understanding that the Indian would never be educated enough to understand what was in him. And in today's day and age, Indian people are becoming more educated and are beginning reading those treaties and begin looking at their rights and are now demanding their rights.
I understand that. But when they're being educated, their culture and all their background is taken away from them. You want to act like the white man. When you're in Rome, you do what the Romans do. And so on. You get to a status of education. I've talked with educated people that came from families that who are monolingual in that department, and they agreed on that a lot of that is erased. A lot of that culture is erased, and there's an environmental conflict, they say, because the foreigner has been raised differently than we have because of different circumstances involved. So on and on, first of all, just continue on that. But as far as sovereignty, it's taken piece by piece, you know, economically, educationally, and otherwise. To the extent of where you depend too much on the United States government for support, but you had no choice. You didn't have no land left to hunt in and fish in the way you were accustomed to living. Mm-hmm. You were coerced right into that particular field. And now they want to bring it back, but that's going to be a hard road to hoe. It's going to be a big job. We're working on that now at the school.
How important is it to go back and retain the culture and the language?
We'll have to get some anthropologists, maybe, huh? Except we have Arvid Mead here.
But you know, in the educational issues, I think there are two fundamental ones in that. And it comes to the core of the issue. Yeah. In 1948, when my father moved down from White Earth to the Twin Cities, in 47 actually, there were 48 Indian students in colleges in the United States, in the entire United States. Now there are over 17,000 attending colleges. Now that seems, if you look at it on the surface, well, that's some progress, people would say. I wonder if it's progress, because there's another issue besides getting Indian students into colleges and into institutions of higher learning or whatever, and that are enabling them to become functional within public schools or colleges. And that's the issue of the content, the issue of what children learn. In Oneida, Wisconsin right now, they have 50 fluent speakers left in that community in Oneida language, and they are desperately concerned about the survival of that language. That it continues in that community. There's other issues involved in that, you know, other kinds of things that people are concerned about what children learn. And I think that although it hasn't been really discussed that much, but I think a fundamental aspect of tribal jurisdiction sovereignty, which has not been squarely addressed, is the educational one. There's a tribe have plenary power to control education for its own members instead of the state. It doesn't have that right in the first place.
Would that solve the question?
Who knows?
How about finance?
Yeah.
That's going to be our biggest problem there.
Well, let me just ask this then. There are groups of people, Indian people, who say that we must go back to the old culture, that we must retain the language, and that education is probably hurt. On the other hand, it was the education of Indians that helped address and discover through the treaties. In other words, we would not be here over the last 10 years if it had not been for an educational process, be it good or be it bad, but the ability to learn to question as an educational process. Mm-hmm. Indian people have learned to question. And it's that questioning which brings us to this period of time into why is there such a big cry in this country now for Indian sovereignty, in some cases even Indian separateness. Was education that bad? Was it really what they said before, the two worst things, mm-hmm. liquor and an education, that the white man gave the Indian? If it had not been for that educational process, would we be where we are today?
No, I am reminded, the way in which I can answer that, I guess, is to look at the human and social cost of education for Indian people. You always have people who drop out and so on and so forth, and no matter where, there are people that just aren't going to make it. But for Indian people in the institutions right now of higher education and so forth, the cost is tremendous. And Indian people, I think, recognize that they need people who can read their treaties and, so on and so forth, although I'm sure they could read it. In fact, the leadership was able to read it at that time, as a matter of fact. The issue is the cost, the human cost of people, of sending children off to schools and so forth, and hoping that we can get some who will return, who will be able to perform that function for the community, is tremendous.
I've never been able to perceive of this myself, of course, with my background, as an either-or situation. American education, normal American education, is probably the only large-scale educational system in the world that feels it's a good idea to just have one language and one culture. European education is very different. To me, there's no reason whatsoever why a person has to give up something else in order to be a literate American, able to function in the white culture. If you go back even as far as Handsome Lake believed, for instance, that two children from each tribe should go to the white schools, if for no other reason than they'd be able to keep an eye on what the whites were up to. There's just no reason why it has to be a matter of choice. I think the basic problem, as Dr. Bolio has addressed, is that education or receiving an education means losing people. And the reason simply is that there's nothing for the educated person to do on the reservation. If you talk about education in terms of career education, and this is where the whole basic economic situation of the reservations comes into play. That if career educated people are a resource, then obviously they have to be put to use within the community for them to benefit the community.
Let's talk about two specific acts before we finish this panel. The Public Law 280 experience in Minnesota, and then eventually the Indian Self-Determination Act and what it may or may not mean here. In Public Law 280, the experiment...
We didn't accept that.
Red Lake hasn't accepted a lot of
things. Act either.
Red Lake hasn't accepted a lot of things. But
Public
Law 280 is experience in these areas, in the nine states that were used as experiments, as state jurisdiction, mm-hmm. in reservation, Minnesota being one of those states. What effect has public law had on the state-Indian relationship in the state of Minnesota? That's a broad question, but I mean, we can start out someplace.
Double taxes, double jeopardy, and all that in law. And the taxes, too. You have to pay your tax indirectly to the tribe, and also to the United States government, and also the state. So you have three taxes there, and you really can't afford one.
What are some of the other effects there? You talked about double jeopardy. In terms of double jeopardy, what effect did it have?
It still has that same effect. We've got one case now where they tried him outside the reservation, and then they brought him in the reservation and tried him again. And that's double jeopardy.
They were tried by the state first?
Right.
And then brought back in and tried by the tribe?
Right.
Why did the tribe try them again?
You didn't play the politics right, that's all. Indian politics. You were on the opposing side.
That's something.
So politics have a very important part in the reservations, I know that. It's personal, because it is personal with them, it's economically justified.
Well, Tom, 1968 civil rights law would give some protection to people on a reservation such as the Red Lake Reservation.
We're being sued on that right now. A lawyer is trying to get a dismissal on it, and that's the last I've heard on law and order.
Actually, it's a protection that the government is providing for the Indians themselves from the type of thing, the political type of discrimination that there might be for certain people on the reservation in the tribal courts.
Yes, there is, and they get by with it because too much authority the tribal court has. Mm-hmm. But we can't do much about it because the others have tried, mm-hmm. and they just created a little trouble for themselves, and they were more or less harassed by it. Now, at one time when we were back in the first government, the tribal council was chiefs. I was spearheaded that one, and that's how come we got another council. All right, we were harassed by the BIA, controlled everything. The law and order, forestry, education, and welfare. Well, we were discriminated on that. Well, I wanted some help one time. I went over just to check them. Well, I says, you've got a good education. Leave the reservation, go outside, make a good living. That was the answer I generally got.
It's a tragic thing, though. It's a tragic situation.
It is a
when
tragic,
one wants to live,
yes.
On this beautiful
some
reservation.
Some people use that for their own.
You say, I don't know, though. The thing is that the United States doesn't protect its own citizens from political abuse or use of courts for that purpose, you know. Right. I mean, and I really wonder, you know, I think at times it may conflict with the sovereignty of a tribe itself.
Mm-hmm.
The tribe's morality, the tribe's as a consensus about what is right and wrong, may differ.
Right. And I think that's a problem that non-Indians would have in facing the jurisdiction of a tribal court.
That's right.
Most tribal courts are a compromising situation.
Mm-hmm.
And non-Indian courts and non-Indian people are clear-cut in a win-lose situation. And I don't think very many people want to get into a compromise situation.
But I think that's what the Supreme Court has been trying to deal with recently, the question of the legitimacy of tribal courts, and at the same time the separation of non-Indians from those courts. Because I mean, if you look at recent Supreme Court decisions, just within the last year, the Supreme Court ruled in a Washington case that the reservation could not try non-Indians. But in another case, it ruled, this was just the other day, reading this in a paper, and I don't remember the details, but it ruled a person who was tried by the tribal court, an Indian person who was tried by the tribal court, could not then be tried under the federal court system because that would constitute double jeopardy. So in that case, the Supreme Court reaffirmed the rights of tribal courts within their own reservation as it applies to Indian people. So, you know, these things are going in different directions, and I think it's because we're really dealing with different issues.
Each separate issue, I think, as it comes up, is dealt with on an individual basis. Indian people are generally lumped into one lump sum. Individual cases, treaties are lumped into one lump sum. It's an Indian treaty, period. And it must affect all Indians, but it doesn't. They affect specific tribes, specific times and places, and in some cases, specific bands. The Supreme Court, I think, itself has said that it is dealing with Indian situations on an individual basis. The fact in Rosebud, South Dakota, the state and the federal government won a territorial jurisdictional boundary dispute, and 4 months later, the same Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Indian tribes in Standing Rock on the northern end of South Dakota for a territorial boundary dispute. No single case seems to me to be able to be a blanket or an example for what will happen in Indian courts or what will happen in the Supreme Court concerning Indians. Mm-hmm. Each one is a separate and an individual right. case. The non-Indian, however, it seems to me, wants a single decision, one single decision which will affect all Indians and separate the peoples. At least that's the way I see it in
Well, I think the difficulty with the way in which the courts are flip-flopping on cases has to do with the way in which Indians are being excluded from the development of those cases in the Justice Department or in the Department of Interior. There needs to be Indian people involved there to be able to construct the issues appropriately, because the courts may be trying a case which is not really the issue, or it may be defined in such a way that the court has to go this way rather than that way. And you need people involved in that process. Most of those decisions are made before it ever gets to the court, in the back room. And it has to be, the process has to be accessible for Indian people in there. And what has happened in the past, it is we talked about the conflict of interest. The conflict of interest was located in the Department of Interior at the assistant secretary level, which had Indian affairs. That's where the conflict was attempted to be resolved.
Right,
it is moving up
to
the ladder now, mm-hmm. and is moving further up, and is getting into the White House, and into, supposedly if this trust council authority gets going with this whole business and so forth, you're going to have, it's too far away. You don't have the White House under scrutiny the way in which, or you don't have Indians accessible to that forum anymore to be able to construct these issues as we are. Jimmy Carter understands Indian people to be just another special interest, to be paired off with hunters or to be paired off with coal people is a special interest group. But Indians aren't a special interest group. They have a special relationship to the federal government. And right now they're going to pull education, you have a plan to pull education out of the Department of Interior or out of BIA and put it into a new department called Department of Education. Where does this status go? Does it come with? Does they move and transfer it? No, I bet you'd be lost. Nor will I, you know. So those are very fundamental issues that are going on right now with this whole aspect. And I think it happens very fast. We just get out of being concerned about the Meads and Cunningham bill, and all of a sudden, boom, we got to worry about Department of Education plan and Carter's reorganization, and then boom, another thing. One has to be on their toes fast. It's lucky Indians have a jet plane now to get around in.
I'm going to ask you, is this right that what they did over in Oklahoma City, I was invited down to get an invocation to the North American Indian physicians, and I listened to their... They made their own constitution bylaws there, and they discriminated no white, just Indians. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether that kind of hit me kind of funny. Oh, I bragged them up. I says I was speaking of the cream of the crop of the Indian nation.
I think there's still a lot of divide and conquer situation involved here that the government has practiced since the beginning. I think that we have to recognize that there are the objectives differ among the various reservations, and then the major differences between the reservation people and off-reservation people in many instances. My brother was a legal aid or lawyer on the Sells at Sells, Arizona, on the Papago Reservation, and he was involved in a Supreme Court case in which an off-reservation Papago was trying to get services from the BIA. The BIA said, no, we don't give services to off-reservation Indians, except in Oklahoma and Alaska. And my brother and the other attorney said this was capricious and went through the court system with it. The BIA went to the tribal people and said, listen, if we lose this case, we've only got so much money, we're going to have to take money away from you in order to provide services to off-reservation Indians. So tribal people were writing amicus curiae briefs in support of the government's position. And this was in 72 or 73. I mean, so this sort of thing is going on all the time. And I think will continue to be a problem.
There's a basic question I think we should try and address here now. What do non-Indians have to fear, if anything, of tribal sovereignty, tribal jurisdiction, tribal self-sufficiency, the ability of tribes to work on their own? What do non-Indians have to fear in that situation?
They can bring an Indian to court in their own court, but the Indian can't bring a white man into court. I had a funny case one time. They caught this Olson stealing hay. And the boys knocked the heck out of him, you know, they caught him. And he came up to court and he says, what have you got to say, Mr. Olson? He says, I'm a working man, not the fighting man, you know. I had a big bag out of it.
I think most non-Indians are essentially coming from the wrong end. If you give tribal people, particularly in not necessarily Red Lake, but other reservations, authority over non-Indians, say, in criminal jurisdiction, that doesn't only mean they're going to be arresting non-Indians, it means they're going to be protecting non-Indians also. Part of police protection is not just arrest, you know, so forth, it's protection of life and property of individuals around and so forth. And that is, it's a valuable service to be provided, which is not often provided for people. And secondly, I think the greatest thing non-Indians have to fear is that if Indians, it's like what Cohen said, go back to that article again, where he said that Indian tribes are like the miner's canary, which performs a valuable function for the rest of society. The miner's canary, of course, dies and lets you know that there's poisonous gas in the mine shaft. And it's a good signal to the rest of society. If Indian people aren't able to have their sovereignty and jurisdiction recognized, to have their freedom recognized, ergo freedom, it's a signal to the rest of society that freedom itself dies, that liberty dies. And that's a valuable lesson to learn. One doesn't have freedom and liberty because you fight for your cause. You have to fight for the cause of liberty itself. Then you have it. And that's, I think, the most valuable lesson of Indian sovereignty and self-government.
If it goes, we all go.
Well, don't declare war yet.
No. Just another very simple answer to the question, what do white people have to fear? For those of us who live around the Leech Lake and White Earth reservations, it's the expiration of leases. There are considerable
uneasiness. That fee up there.
But is it really an expiration of leases, or is it merely a renegotiation of the leases that are there? There are some awful cheap leases all around this country. Cattlemen in the western part of the United States are leasing Indian land for like $1 an acre, per year, and paying no tax on that land, but paying tax on the cattle on that land, where the guy across the fence either has bought the land or is leasing it at $7 or $8 or $9 or $10 a year per acre and is paying taxes not only on the land but on the cattle as well. So those people have an interest, a vested interest in a cheap lease.
But you know, you put that right into, you know, people around here, I'm sure, have their apartment leases raised yearly, you know, and they have to pay a little more to rent a space in a building. But they don't complain that way,
no.
You know. They recognize, well, the costs are gone up and this and that has gone up. They'll pay the landlord. Or if they can't afford it, they go somewhere else. It's a basic recognition of who the landlord is.
That's the problem, though, is that recognition of who the landlord will be. Isn't that the situation that we're in right now in 1978 between the Indian and the non-Indian, is the recognition of who the landlord is going to be, who's going to collect that rent?
The only thing about it, though, you know, and at times it's tragic to admit it, non-Indians are so ignorant about the realities of the history of this own area, and the realities of the situation. I think it's horrible. Not only that, you know, that they may have just plain old attitudes, but they're just plain ignorant most of the time about it. And I think there's a fundamental educational need or a fundamental need for school districts to stand up for at least truth. Ignorance is at times functional. When you notice what the economy of this area is like and who is indeed controlled it, and who benefits from it, and so on and so forth, that's when you get down to the real issues of it. You know, people make money off of Indian resources and lands. Indians don't.
Resource people for the historic experience have been Dr. David Bolio, University of Minnesota, Dr. Dolores Norman and Alan Brew of Bemidji State University, and Tom Kane, tribal historian. This is the Northwoods American Indian Experience.